like this message, if I could send no other message, is no matter how you're going to try and grow your family naturally using reproductive technologies, whatever, addressing insulin resistance is only going to help you, your pregnancy success rate, your baby in utero, your baby beyond utero, like their rates of their own expression of PCOS or their own expression of diabetes or their own weight struggles are programmed to a degree in utero and even somewhat preconception.
Hey, I'm Jackie Kirshen, obsessed with all things sustainable weight loss, mindful eating, transforming minds, and empowering you. I'm a registered dietitian and mom who's lost 65 pounds and grew a successful coaching business helping other women do the same. Join me to learn tried and true weight loss secrets while healing your relationship with food and your body. You'll get unfiltered real talk, support, and some tough Jackie love as we dive into motherhood, mindset shift, entrepreneurship, and mastering this crazy thing called life. Think of this as your one-stop shop for a coffee date with your best friend, guide, and mentor mixed with weight loss coaching. Tune in to be challenged, encouraged, and laugh as we change lives together. Welcome to the Mindful Nutritionist Show. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Mindful Nutritionist Show. Oh, am I so excited for this episode. What I had to do, because it was so jam-packed, I actually broke it up into two parts because I was like, whoa, this is literally for anyone with PCOS. This is a gold mine. So not only are you getting part one, but you're also going to get part two with one of my dear friends, Caitlin Johnson, who is also a registered dietitian and an expert in PCOS and women's health. We both have PCOS. If you guys don't know about my story, again, I talk a lot about my PCOS and infertility journey. And gosh, did I wish I was friends with Caitlin many years ago. She brings over a decade of experience in helping women navigate the complex challenges of PCOS, insulin resistance, and fertility issues. If those like three things ring a bell for you, stick around for part one and part two. I mean, we literally dove deep into like the hormonal interplays of leptin, insulin, reproductive health, the critical roles of fullness cues, overeating, and just how to get pregnant, right? She shared really important tips about when it comes to getting annual checkups and the specific lab work and the different markers you should be asking for, different medications, really managing insulin resistance, PCOS symptoms. I mean, literally all of the things, right? And what I love about her is that not only is she just an awesome person, but she's also struggled with infertility in her own journey to motherhood, weight loss as well, and she's very open about it. So this conversation really dives deep into the misconceptions around PCOS and just really about why we struggle as PCOS sisters that, you know, it's been really hard when it comes to weight loss, right? And really, you know, what are the different types of movements? And even when it comes to supplements and things like that, you guys are probably hearing so many things online and on Instagram, take this, don't take this. And she really just breaks down what you should be doing, right? And what's going to be best for you and how to make those informed decisions for yourself, right? So I won't get too into it because I want to dive right in. And again, I want you to listen to part one, then part two, because they're broken up in a way. It's just, it's a meaty, long episode. So you're welcome. I didn't want to overload you. And I also want to preface, if you don't have PCOS, I still, if you are ready to start a family and if you're struggling with hormonal issues or even weight loss, then this episode is still for you. So definitely want you to stay tuned, listen to part one, maybe take a little bit of a breather, go have some matcha latte or whatever, come back for part two, and let's dive in. But before we dive into today's episode, I just wanted to take a minute to shout out to our amazing podcast sponsors. We have PETA 22 and Juice Jerky. You guys will hear a little bit more about a sweet offer that they have for you. But first, let's get to the episode. All right, welcome to another episode of the Mindful Nutritionist Show. I am so excited for my guest today because not only is she a colleague and a friend in the space, but also a very similar niche. As many of you know, I've been through my own 65-pound weight loss journey and I have PCOS and I struggled with infertility going through IVF with Olivia and naturally 13 weeks pregnant right now. So welcome, Caitlin, our PCOS expert.
Yes. Hello. Happy to be here. That's I didn't know that about your story, that you did, you had reproductive assistance the first time and this time naturally. That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Both ways are really beautiful.
Both ways. And so very fortunate, because I just remember someone, I'm not going to name names, but someone definitely said to me after my transfer, I said, "Will I ovulate on my own?" And she said confidently, "Nope." And
wow.
I feel like I'm kind of like proving it wrong. But yeah, we'll get into that. But why don't you tell all of our listeners who you are and how you ended up as the PCOS expert?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Caitlin Johnson. I am a registered dietitian as well. I have some extra training in women's herbalism and some functional and integrative training. And just am a lover of women's health. I remember having some really terrible experiences with some physicians and then landing in a really great OB's office. And every time I'd go to my annual physical, I would be like, maybe I should go to school to be an OB, because she just makes me feel so wonderful. And everybody should feel that way. I want to help people feel that way. And she was actually the person that really helped me in my PCOS journey. Was not the one that diagnosed me, but I've always just had something drawing me to women's health. And I was diagnosed with PCOS at 18, was delivered the diagnosis, asked what it was, basically got told it's the number one reason why women in America can't get pregnant. And that's not why I was seeing the doctor. Actually, really is not what PCOS is. It's like a very terrible explanation, in my opinion, and poor bedside manner. But looking back, it's like that, like I like to say that, like Bridget Jones' Diary moment, where like you leave the office and the music changes and you're walking home in clothes that don't fit and pouring rain, getting ice cream. Like it was that turning point for me that was like made me dig deeper and figure out what I wanted to do with my life, which ended up being studying nutrition. So fast forward, I mean, I was diagnosed with PCOS 20 years ago. I'm 38.
Wow.
Crazy. I've lived my life more now knowing that I have PCOS.
With that diagnosis, yeah.
I know. Isn't that kind of crazy? I've been treating women with PCOS in private practice for about 10 years. We struggled with infertility as well. Did conceive. We have three beautiful children. I'm a mom of three. It took us about 3 years to get pregnant with my daughter, and it didn't need to take that long. Like what I learned in my journey should have really shortened that, and has for so many women that I've worked with. And so my world, my impact on the world has morphed and changed over the years, especially becoming a mother, limiting my working hours, wanting to kind of expand my impact. We have a fertility-specific podcast. So if anybody's listening to this that's really interested in fertility, Food Freedom Fertility is another podcast I do with a functional medicine dietitian. And we span all context of fertility support. So it's not just about PCOS. And we recently, in the last year, launched two really big things. The first is the PCOS app, and that's available on Apple and Android. And it has weekly recipes that we release, blog articles, videos, its own like very succinct podcast. So episodes are 5 or 8 minutes long, and they're very actionable. Like, learn about this thing. Here's how you can implement it in your life. And it's kind of, I'm hoping that it will become the like, don't go to Google to ask the question, open the PCOS app, type your question, you'll find the article. So we're really designing the content to answer specific questions that people have asked about PCOS.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's been hard and wonderful. And then the other thing that we launched in the last year was PCOS formularies, which has at this point 5 products that are specifically designed to treat root cause pieces of PCOS struggles and things that contribute to like the root of PCOS. So things like insulin resistance, inflammation, some irregularities with like leptin resistance and appetite issues that women with PCOS have. So we're like specifically designing things to support those pathways that our bodies have a little bit harder time with and struggle in. So I'm hoping that the next few years will look like those things really take off and really help a lot of people. And we can just keep sowing the fruit that comes from it back into those projects and see what kind of impact we can have on the PCOS community.
It's amazing because I work with a lot of women with PCOS. I don't, again, like say I'm a PCOS weight loss dietitian, because I will say my diagnosis was much later. I was diagnosed when I failed my first few IUIs. And then when I remember I did two other IUIs at a fertility center with the kind of like, oh, I'm kind of going down the direction of IVF. So like, I might as well establish care here. And I'll never forget. Again, I loved my doctor. She was so sweet, but she called me skinny PCOS. And that just like kind of totally triggered me, especially for someone who struggled with their weight their entire life. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh my God, this is now making sense. And mm-hmm. so I know that there's just kind of like two camps. It's either you're struggling with weight gain and you keep gaining weight and you can't lose weight, or you have these people that have no idea that they have PCOS and they're struggling getting pregnant. And then for me, I was told I needed to gain weight in order to ovulate and get pregnant. So it's, again, these two camps of like, you got to lose weight, like we were talking about, 5 to 10% body fat in order to ovulate, or then you have some other people that don't have enough body fat percent. So can you speak to both in terms of like, what's the science? What actually has to happen?
Yeah, I think a lot of times there is a distinction that people will make in our community where we'll look at something and we'll go, this person's not ovulating. When I see that, I think, why aren't they ovulating? And you want to follow kind of like the fingerprints that are presented, the data, both in what we can pull from medical history. You don't want to just like look at someone and say, oh, well, you're skinny, so it's not PCOS. Because I had providers say that to me, and I'm like, well, you didn't see me when my PCOS was wildly unmanaged and I had a lot of inflammation and my insulin resistance was just sky high. I could be that person with different inputs in my body. And a lot of people can at different points in their lifespan be on different ends of that spectrum. Like at the beginning of your weight loss journey, even though you may not have had a PCOS diagnosis then, didn't necessarily mean you didn't have PCOS, right?
Yeah.
And so the symptoms manifest at different times with different inputs. Maybe at this point, like in my time right now, my weight's a little bit higher than when my PCOS has been managed best, but my stress is also a lot higher. And I think that the stress is actually fueling my symptoms a lot more than the weight, because I'm actually am balancing my blood sugar really well. So when I'm looking at someone and they come in and it's like, well, we're not getting pregnant, and I know we're not getting pregnant, at least one of the reasons is that I'm not ovulating, then you got to kind of follow the trail before you. So I will often not even consider the weight until I have lab work, because I think the lab work can tell us a lot. There is pretty consistent lab work that shows evidence of PCOS. And a couple of the things that I'm looking at when we're looking at reproductive health are things like AMH. So in the most recent kind of international guidelines for the treatment of PCOS, we're starting to use AMH since those guidelines were released as kind of like a surrogate marker for polycystic ovaries. So if you have a really high AMH, sometimes they will forego now doing an ultrasound to actually image your ovaries and see if they're polycystic. And so that's a really interesting thing, because AMH in the fertility world is a marker for ovarian reserve. And so for somebody to come in and then see a really high number, initially that seems like, well, that's great, I have a lot of ovarian reserve.
That's what I thought when they told me that. It was like 11 something. I was like, good, I've got eggs.
Yeah, which is true, actually. Yeah. You do. Yeah. But AMH is produced by small developing follicles. And every cycle, your body kind of sequesters a number of really small baby eggs, we'll call them, that kind of get tapped on the shoulder to get like put on deck, for a baseball reference. Like they're getting ready to be put into the game. And earlier in your reproductive years, there are more of those every cycle. Towards the end of your reproductive years, we have less of a pool that we're pulling from, or the quality of the eggs is degrading over time. And so that number AMH tends to go down. So it is true for most PCOS women that they do have more eggs because they haven't been ovulating them most of their life as others have. But that high AMH can be kind of like a fingerprint that, yeah, it probably is PCOS. It also tells me you have a lot of follicles that are trying to mature. But if you're telling me you're not ever getting a cycle, I can very confidently tell you you're not ovulating, and so they're getting stuck. And that is very classic in the picture of PCOS, is like your body's trying to get these eggs to mature to the point where one could be picked and be ovulated, but it's really struggling in the process. And so AMH is one that I like to look at. LH and FSH, so luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone, those are another couple labs. And all three of those labs are actually fairly inexpensive to run. And you could ask your primary care provider to run them. You could ask your OB. You don't necessarily have to move down the steps to like a reproductive endocrinologist or a different type of fertility doctor to get those done. Your dietitian could even run them in most states. And the ratio of LH and FSH is very telling. In PCOS, this isn't always, but most of the time, LH is much higher than FSH. And this should only happen in your cycle right before you ovulate. And so if it's happening all throughout your cycle, or we just pick a random time point because you're not cycling and we see that this is very high, we can kind of interpret that and go, okay, that's another like feather in my cap thinking this is PCOS, and that is stalling ovulation. I am full circle coming back to your question about how do you treat them differently.
Because it makes sense, because my FSH, I remember, was like non-existent. And I was like, okay, I get it. I'm not ovulating. It was like literally in the male category.
Mm-hmm. So FSH stands for follicle stimulating hormone. And that's going to be highest towards the beginning of your cycle, as your body's taking those like very immature eggs and trying to mature them to the point that one could be dominant and become the egg that gets ovulated. And then all the rest kind of like disintegrate, and the next cycle you start all over. So when you pull those labs and you see FSH and LH, but mostly FSH, either really, really low, then that can tell you your body's struggling to feel safe to ovulate. And that may be more of a picture of what we call hypothalamic amenorrhea, where there are limited resources in your body's view right now. And that might be under eating. It may not be under eating. It could be like chronic over exercising. Mm-hmm. It could also be an illness that's like requiring a lot of energy and draining your body's stores. That's a little bit less common, but I have seen that a couple times. And hypothalamic amenorrhea, where your body has limited resources and doesn't feel safe to reproduce, because your body's going to first prioritize you, then offspring, if we're just thinking evolutionarily or biologically. Like that's true in animal kingdom everywhere, right? So it's going to shunt resources away from reproductive health. And so like when you and I were probably in our early teens and seeing the US Olympics doing really well, gymnast wise, like that's what my sex ed teacher talked about when women didn't have a period, like that athlete with no body fat.
No fat, yeah.
And it was almost seen as like an athletic person's problem, but it's actually not just an athletic person's problem. It can be an under-eating problem, an eating disorder problem. It can be an over-exercising problem. You know, if you had like a Iron Woman type person, that person could be under-fueling for what their body is being required in them. So those are things that labs can give us a view on. And then FSH is also interesting. If it's really high, so FSH Your brain is the one that tells your ovaries what to do. If your brain is working really hard, making lots of FSH, telling your ovaries to mature a follicle, that's a pretty good indication that there is low ovarian reserve, or there might be what we would call like a premature menopause coming on. So, or premature ovarian failure is another way people talk about it. So those labs can be really telling. Now, they're not everything, and they're not always a reason to despair. It's just information. So if somebody came into me and they had a history of being overweight and they were really underweight and we pulled labs and they had high AMH and the LH and FSH were kind of normal, I would say we need to look at things like insulin and glucose and adrenal androgens and kind of try and fill in the rest of the picture. But by and large, more of the PCOS population struggles with weight, struggles with insulin resistance, and struggles to ovulate. And like those things very commonly overlap. So for the wide majority of women with PCOS, working on that insulin resistance really improves reproductive health no matter how you get pregnant.
Yeah.
So if we can improve insulin resistance, we are going to improve the quality of your eggs, period. End of story. And you might ovulate because we've improved those things. You might ovulate because you take letrozole or Clomid. You might do IVF and have like a lot of medicines on board. IVF doctors love PCOS patients because there's usually a lot of follicles and a lot of success rates given some certain parameters. So there's a lot of hope in the fertility landscape. But generally, you know, more of the people that I work with that struggle to ovulate or ovulate very infrequently do also struggle with insulin resistance and would themselves represent themselves as somebody that struggles with their weight. It's a little bit less often that I see someone in a leaner body size that struggles as much with ovulation. But when that is the case, there's often a very large stress component and adrenal component to their PCOS. And so it's just kind of like, I don't think that we have a lot of good research on this. I think there are a big handful, thankfully, or there's a growing handful of practitioners that work in this day in and day out and are seeing some of the trends that we'd really love to see some research catch up to help us more directly treat people based on their symptoms and their lab work and kind of the presentation of their PCOS, because it really is a wide spectrum of symptoms, of cycle disruptions, of ovulation disruptions. Like it can look like so many different things, even though there is like a most common kind. If somebody were to come in, it's like you're kind of teasing out like what bucket do you fall in, and maybe what areas are you a little bit different from everybody else in that bucket so that we can treat you very individually, especially when we're talking about fertility.
Yeah, and you know what? It's so hard, especially now with people, the louder they get, the more people listen to them, right? So there's people who are just saying some really just like messed up things. And there's other people that is like, oh, well, this supplement, you know, popped up on my feed. So I love that you also started this line. We also had Corey Ruth, the women's dietitian on, you know, and I love that you guys are just like trying to fight the good fight. So I want to circle back to insulin resistance, because this is thrown around, this term, these two words, so much. And when I started in the bariatric space with my bariatric surgeon who I worked for, and I just think it was like such a scare tactic and that he used when it was just like, oh, you're insulin resistant, we're doing bypass, we're going to fix it, we're going to reverse that. And so it was something that we just kind of like, and I'm glad I got into my space because I did more, you know, research and understanding and practice in terms of like, you know, the difference between insulin resistance and insulin sensitivity. And so how we can really use food to cure and not have to go on the table and have our, you know, half of our stomach, three quarters of our stomach taken out and all of these things. So can you not only just clarify what is insulin resistance? How do we know the difference between insulin resistance and sensitivity? And, you know, what are, I guess, implications and what can we do about it without having to go to extremes of weight loss medications and things like that?
Yeah, it's a real interesting term because, frankly, it's a growing problem in first world countries. Like we're seeing more and more and more rates of things like diabetes where there are extreme levels of insulin resistance. So I kind of want to break this question apart as what is insulin resistance? Why does it matter to PCOS? And then kind of go into the depths of it. So insulin's a hormone. A hormone in your body sends a message. It goes from one part of your body to another to communicate something. Your pancreas is an organ kind of near your stomach-ish in that range. If you didn't take all the classes that Jacqueline and I had to take. Yeah. And it makes insulin. It's the only one. If you're type 1 diabetic, you don't make enough insulin or you don't make any. And so you have to inject it and you need insulin. You will not live without insulin. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the advent of being able to harness insulin from animals made type 1 diabetics' lifespans multiply in the 18th and 19th century because of insulin, like our understanding of insulin. So this is huge. Type 1 diabetes is very different than when your body has a part of your lifetime where it was very responsive to insulin, and then all of a sudden it kind of stops responding to it. So this hormone that's being sent from one area to another, the message is having trouble getting through. Okay, so you could think about when you call like your cable company to say your internet's not working and you're just like stuck on hold. That's kind of like what insulin's struggling with, like stuck on hold, can't get to the cell to tell the cell what it does. Well, the main messages insulin sends are, number one, energy resources are available. Usually this is blood sugar, but it's not the only type of energy resource. And because it's available, open up those little proteins on the side of the cell and let that energy in. Okay. So it's kind of like an abundance hormone. It's telling your body things are there. Because of that, it's actually a growth hormone. And its other secondary signal is energy is available. Store some for later. And this is where a lot of people might make more insulin or less insulin given the same amount of food, and genetics plays a huge piece of this. And person A might be really good at using all that energy because they have a faster metabolism, and person B doesn't. And so that extra energy and that secondary message it sends some extra energy to storage in the form mostly of fat in our bodies. There's other forms, but that's a lot of where we see some of the problems with insulin resistance. So insulin resistance is the opposite of being sensitive to insulin, meaning like you call and you're put on hold and like a second later, somebody, the very nice person on the other end of the line answers and fixes the problem. Like that's the customer service we all want and you hardly ever get. Like that is insulin sensitivity. They care about you. They're sorry you had to wait at all. Let me
like when you call Amazon and you get that one person and it's really quick. That's insulin sensitivity.
Exactly. So you can see that one is kind of frustrating and your body feels that. And so it starts making more and more and more insulin. It's like, you're not answering my text. You're not answering my text. Okay, I'm going to text you more. Now I'm going to call you. Okay. Yeah. You didn't send my kid home yet. I'm walking over to your house. Like, so you step up. Your pancreas does that until your pancreas can't make enough to fight the good fight. And your body is becoming so resistant, insulin resistance, to the message.
Before we continue with today's incredible episode, I just wanted to take a moment to tell you a little bit more about our amazing sponsors of today's podcast. So let me tell you the sweet deals that they have for you. Hey, San Diego foodies. Let me tell you about my latest obsession, Pita 22 in Carmel Valley. It's not your average Israeli restaurant. It's a flavor paradise tailored perfectly for your taste buds and health goals. Imagine Mediterranean dishes crafted from scratch with love and fresh, healthy ingredients, no sneaky artificial additives. From homemade pitas to labneh and even tomato sauce, there are no shortcuts taken here. And their menu is a dream for everyone. Vegetarian delights like house-made falafel and crispy cauliflower with tahini, which is my absolute favorite. They also have family-friendly favorites like chicken schnitzel, which my daughter Olivia loves, and the softest homemade pita bread you'll ever taste. I've spent 11 summers in Israel, and trust me, this is the best Mediterranean food. And here's the best part. As a Mindful Nutritionist Show listener, when you head on over to Pita 22 and use the code MINDFUL, you'll get a free hummus. Yup, that is a special treat just for us podcast listeners. So whether you're in for a hearty grilled kebab or a delicious weekend breakfast like shakshuka, Pita 22 has got you covered. I'm a regular, the flavors never disappoint, and perfectly complement your wellness journey. So join me at Pita 22, indulge in fantastic flavors, and remember to use the code MINDFUL for that free hummus, and I can't wait to see you there. I have to tell you about my family's latest fruit snack obsession called juice jerky we found at a San Diego farmer's market. It's a guilt-free, delicious, and smart choice for your health journey. I was confused by the name at first, but when I learned it's just blended and dehydrated fruit that's lower in calories with no added sugar, I had to try it. It has this amazing texture and chew just like jerky with sweet, tart, and spicy flavors like my favorite mango pineapple. My daughter Olivia loves the blueberry. And the best part, no blue stained hands or mouths here. Why do I love it as a mom and dietitian? Well, it's an easy snack and so versatile. Top it on cereal, yogurt, or even use it as a cocktail garnish. It's my go-to car snack for days chauffeuring Olivia around with no sugar high, just a tasty pick-me-up. And you get a special treat as a podcast listener. Use the code MINDFUL at checkout for a sweet 15% off your first order. Yup, a delicious discount just for tuning in. Whether you're on the go, at the office, camping, or packing your kids' lunch, Juice Jerky has your snack game covered. Indulge your taste buds, make a mindful choice, and get that 15% off with code MINDFUL, and let's snack smarter together.
Now, you can have insulin resistance and not have diabetes, okay? And this is where I think a lot of our medical providers are getting it wrong, is we're only testing and treating typically until the Ozempic Wegovy world that we're in right now. We're only treating insulin resistance once it gets to the point where it's like dire, okay? And what I would like to say to anybody with PCOS that's listening to this, or anybody that thinks they might have insulin resistance that's listening to this, is that it is important to start eating to address this and moving your body to address this and manage your stress to address this and learn to sleep better to address this long before it gets to the point of diabetes.
Yeah.
And even an early pre-diabetes or an early diabetes diagnosis, it's very often reversible given behavior change. So in PCOS, why this is important in PCOS is because our body communicates a little differently. And one of the areas that it does is in the ovary specifically. And high levels of insulin correlate to high levels of ovary-generated testosterone. So when people talk about high androgens or high male hormones, this is one of the main hormones that they're typically talking about. It's very common in PCOS to have high testosterone. And so as you're flooded with more and more insulin, your ovaries sending more and more of that message of testosterone. And the testosterone itself can stop ovulation. The insulin also kind of shunts one specific vitamin within the ovary, inositol, from one form to another, so myo-inositol into dichiro-inositol, too quickly. And that in and of itself can lower egg quality and drive someone to struggle to ovulate. And so there are insulin-dependent pathways within the body that are making symptom expression worse. And so that could look like hair falling out, could look like chin hair becoming coarser and more abundant, could look like acne. High levels of testosterone also make it hard for you to lose belly fat. And so if you think about that, like you think about how men age and where they carry their weight, it's a very testosterone dominant picture, and it's all right in that midsection, that beer belly. It's really a testosterone belly. And that's very common in PCOS as well, where the high levels of testosterone themselves become a weight loss inhibition. It makes it a little bit harder to lose weight. We see as insulin levels go up, so does something called leptin resistance. And leptin is that hormone that tells you you're full. And so if you're resistant to the message that you've eaten enough, it can become very easy to overeat and struggle with kind of your fullness and satiety cues that your body kind of naturally has. So insulin resistance, it's a bear, like it's a beast. And there are so many, the good news is there are so many really simple ways you can address it. Some that are behavior, some that are supplements, some that are medication. And I think that there's a time and a place for all of those, and layering them in is only going to be more helpful. So like pulling from one dietary strategy until you've got that down, and then pulling from one movement strategy until you've got that down. But one thing that almost no one's talking about, and I can't wait till we get some good research on it, is high levels of insulin I'm seeing correlate to low levels of progesterone when people do ovulate. And I think that we're going to see research in the next 5 to 10 years on low levels of progesterone in PCOS patients being one of the main reasons we have higher miscarriage rates. And so like this message, if I could send no other message, is no matter how you're going to try and grow your family naturally using reproductive technologies, whatever, addressing insulin resistance is only going to help you, your pregnancy success rate, your baby in utero, your baby beyond utero, like their rates of their own expression of PCOS or their own expression of diabetes or their own weight struggles are programmed to a degree in utero and even somewhat preconception. And so I think it's very important that we start talking about insulin resistance at diagnosis of PCOS, that it could be a problem, and that that education is required to help somebody have the toolkit they need to take care of their body with this diagnosis.
I think that's so important. And also I love and this is why I like you and we get along, is because you said all three, right? There's all three interventions, where you have some people who are like, only medications and throw medications. And there's some people are like, no, all natural. You don't need this. So can you tell our listeners, you know, now that we understand more in depth of, you know, insulin resistance and how it affects us, how do we find out if that is something that we struggle with? Yeah, and maybe some of those dietary, behavioral, and medical supplement, you know, interventions that we can take?
Yeah. So your doctor very typically will pull in an annual checkup your A1C, your hemoglobin A1C, and a fasting glucose. The fasting glucose is typically just a part of a comprehensive metabolic panel that also zooms in at things like your liver and your kidneys. Fasting glucose is helpful. It's one time point. Generally, your fasting glucose will be sort of within like a tight range for you for a period of time. Like there's not a heck of a lot of variance out of maybe like 5 or 10% of a number typically. Your A1C, it's not looking at like one morning time point. It's giving us a window into what your average glucose levels have been over around a 90-day range. And the reason why we know that is because the life cycle of a red blood cell is about 90 days. And hemoglobin A1C is measuring how many of these red blood cells have this kind of like sugar-like particle attached to it. And so we have ranges that equal diabetes, equal prediabetes, and then basically a range that is normal. Okay, so if you're in this normal range, typically your doctor is going to say nothing's a problem. I had my doctor, our normal family provider, tell my husband, who had a pre-diabetic A1C and a fasting blood glucose of like 103, which is higher than quote unquote normal, that it's probably nothing. And I was like, that's not probably nothing. Like, you know, probably nothing means we do nothing about it. And 4 years from now, it's diabetes. Like, we need to be catching people much earlier. Now, I would argue that A1C and fasting glucose are asking the wrong questions. What we're zooming in there is, what is your body capable of doing overnight for your blood sugar and over a 90-day period for your blood sugar? It's not asking, how is it holding these numbers within range? And that's really the question we should be asking. And a great way to get a glimpse into that is to pull a fasting insulin level and a fasting glucose level. And then you can take that if you Google HOMA-IR, HOMA-IR, the bloodcode.com has a nice calculator on it where you can put in your fasting glucose number and fasting insulin, and it shoots out this index. It's an index. It's like the body mass index. It's not a perfect system, but it takes those numbers and does this little calculation with it. And then it gives you a number like 2.6 or 0.8 or 5.9. And then you can take that to the range and say, okay, anything 1.5 and below is insulin sensitive. There's no issue. Anything like 1.5 to 2 is like early insulin resistance. 2 and above, I would say, is frank insulin resistance. And 3 and above is like, this is severe insulin resistance. I see people all the time that are not flagged as pre-diabetic or diabetic that have severe insulin resistance all the time. Numbers in the 6s or 12s. But you look at their fasting glucose and it's 98. And anything 99 and below is quote unquote
normal. Yeah.
But did it take 6 insulin to get there or 40 insulin to get there?
Yeah.
And that's the question the HOMA-IR is trying to answer, is like, okay, you're kind of on the borderline, you're on the high end of the normal range, but how much insulin is it taking to keep you in that range? If that answer to that question is high and a lot, there is insulin resistance present and we need to start addressing it. So that's how I like to look at it. I think there's other ways that we're starting to look at kind of metabolic syndrome in general, where you can do something like a waist to hip circumference. Sometimes I'll just ask patients questions. So for instance, if I have somebody that for one reason or another, we're struggling to get lab work on, fasting insulin and fasting glucose, your doctor should pull for you. If he's unwilling or she's unwilling, you should find a new doctor, period, end of story. Like, that's so basic.
Totally agree.
But nevertheless, if you find yourself in this position, if you just get like a, you know, like a tape measure you'd use for sewing, like something that's flexible, do your waist circumference and your hip circumference. If your waist circumference is more than your hip circumference, there's a pretty good chance there's insulin resistance on board. And there are a number of questions that I'll ask, things like night urination or thirst, that are more related to insulin resistance that you tend to see when there's diabetes on board, but I see it in patients, you know, before things progress that far. So natural interventions, lifestyle interventions, some of the biggest things that I think about are not restrictive, like move your body. So, you know, over the last 6 months, my husband and I have been working to address things like his insulin resistance, and both of us lose a little bit of weight. And the first thing we started with was an evening walk. Like, we got our bodies doing more steps than we were doing before. And today I had a realization that, like, I just really wanted to go on a walk. It's been so cold lately. I was like, I'm just bundling up and I'm going to go. And I noted in my head, like, it's so good that this is a habit now. And it's not like, oh, I got to go walk 3 miles. It's like, oh my gosh, I get to go walk 3 miles today. I'm so excited. I felt very differently about that 6 months ago. Small things like that. Exercise actually moves the needle for insulin resistance really quickly, whether your weight changes or not. We have research that movement, getting your muscles to move in a way that they have to consume glucose more, kind of turns on the ability for insulin to talk to them again. And so that's a really beautiful way that you can sneak things in. You can do exercise snacks, like some squats when you're waiting for the microwave to finish warming up lunch, you could go for a 10-minute walk after lunch. You could get yourself a walking pad if you're on Zoom calls all day that you don't have to be really talkative on, but you have to be present for. Like, there are ways to sneak in movement that don't have to feel like 40 minutes at the gym. And I think that that's one really beautiful thing that almost everybody could choose a way to be a little bit more active or active in a different way for themselves. When I think of nutrition, because obviously you and I are going to think about that as dietitians.
Always.
I think some of the biggest things that I have seen be really successful, you can do without weighing a food, without counting a calorie. It's like when you look at your plate, is the protein portion bigger than the carb portion? It's one really easy way to say, like we had pizza for dinner last night. That wasn't the case. That was not a meal that I would say was incredibly blood sugar balancing. So what did I do? We had chicken the night before and I just pulled out half a breast of chicken and had it next to my pizza. And so I'm just upping my protein to kind of carb ratio there without ever having to track a thing. And that has worked for a lot of clients of mine. Increasing fiber is a really great way to work on insulin resistance. When we're choosing carbohydrates, making sure that they're either higher in fiber or you have a lot of fiber on the side of them. One great way that I love to do that is choosing some of these pasta alternatives that are made of like garbanzo beans that are higher in fiber, higher in protein than a typical wheat noodle. I like to sneak in things like artichoke hearts into recipes that you wouldn't otherwise maybe put them in. Like, I put artichoke hearts in my spaghetti sauce very often, or we throw them on our pizza because they're very high in protein or very high in fiber. So looking for protein and fiber. Interestingly, research shows that breakfast eaters tend to ovulate more than those that don't eat a robust breakfast, and that eating more according to the circadian rhythm, so like eating earlier in the day your larger meals and more like the bird in the evening, and it doesn't need to be that small, but like front loading the day on your calories and kind of like lunch is a moderate size and dinner is a smaller size, that actually correlates really well with improving insulin resistance, even if we don't change what you're eating. We just change working like with the cycle of your body when it's going to be most apt to consume and use the insulin that's made. And so those are some like quick things that I always think about. I like to crowd off the plate or upgrade things versus restrict. One thing that I think that's a really awesome switch is something like green tea or spearmint tea instead of soda or another sugar sweetened beverage, because we're approaching your PCOS from multiple perspectives there. We're including antioxidants, we're lowering testosterone medicinally with those teas, and we're also exchanging something that may have kind of had like a emotional support or reliance, maybe that afternoon soda fix, or as my old nanny, she used to drink her Diet Coke on the way to work. And I was like, oh my gosh, every day you walk in with your Diet Coke, can I die a little bit?
Oh my gosh. At like 8 a.m.
Yeah. She's so sweet. So, you know, those are things that I think of. The problem that I see a lot of people run into, and there's a lot of backlash against doctors in the PCOS world, and it's very much because I think there's a huge gap in nutrition education, period, even just like rudimentary for a medical provider. And we could talk about that up and down all around. But doctors don't really have a lot of time with you, and their toolbox is generally medication or surgery.
Yeah.
So a lot of times people are going to their doctor expecting for diet advice or support towards goals that they're not well suited to support you in. And they are going to offer what they can offer. And that's typically, at least to start off with, medication. So at a diagnostic appointment, very often a woman's going to leave with a PCOS diagnosis, no matter why they went in, with a prescription for hormonal contraceptives, maybe a prescription for metformin, a prescription for something like spironolactone if you're struggling with hair loss or hair growth or acne. If you're more in a fertility pursuit, you might leave with a prescription for Clomid or letrozole. More often, things that are getting recommended as we're seeing FDA regulations kind of work in the drug company's favor, yeah, and maybe in the patient's favor, depending on what light you discuss these things. A lot of practitioners are starting to move to these GLP-1 options, which are basically semaglutide, right? And this is something that's been used in medicine for at least 20-ish years, typically in diabetics, but it has expanded to weight loss with the approval of Wegovy. So like Ozempic is typically diagnosed to somebody that has a diabetes, or prescribed to somebody that has diabetes diagnosis. Wegovy is a higher dose of that drug typically, and that is something that's being offered to someone that may just need to lose weight. So they're in typically more like a morbid obesity category. But if you want it and you're willing to pay for it, if your insurance won't approve it for what category BMI you're in or what other diagnoses that you might have co-occurring that would give them reason to maybe try and improve things for their financial interests, not for your health, you may get approved for something like Wegovy. I'm seeing a lot of people go the route because those medicines are in short supply or very expensive. They're getting prescriptions for semaglutide that's being compounded at compounding pharmacies. So it's not coming in like an injectable, where it's just like you push a button and it injects. Like you actually have to measure out with a syringe and give yourself a shot weekly. I've seen that be a lot more common. And I personally kind of straddle the line in my opinion about these things. And I'm happy to go through medicine by medicine if you want. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I love it.
It's crowd.
No, definitely. I'm sure they're, because it gets confusing. And it's so funny because when this started coming, I was like, I feel like I'm back in my bariatric days, because these things, again, when I did a lot with fen-phen and orlistat and things that, you know, were not, you know, GLP-1s and semaglutides, but I did that with my diabetics. And yeah, so like, you know, kind of what are your thoughts? Pros, cons, worth it, not worth it? What do you feel? Okay, so I know you are probably like jaw to the floor and like, what? And that was only part one, right? So I'm not even going to keep you any longer. I want you to go to part two, the next episode, so you can get the rest of this juicy, juicy, juicy meaty episode. And I'll see you there. Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed that conversation just as much as I did. As always, anything mentioned, any links, any notes will all be linked on our website, mindfulnutritionistshow.com. Just head on over there to take a look. And if you haven't connected with me yet personally, I would love to meet you. Come and find me on Instagram at the.mindful.nutritionist, and please DM me. Let me know if you listened to the episode and what you thought. I seriously love hearing from you. Or come to the Mindful Nutritionist Show Facebook page and say hi. I would love to connect with you there. Thanks so much for being here and for being so amazing. I can't wait to chat next time.